property. And that's really what determines what happens with water resources. What happens in the land indicates what's happening with the water quality. We also use this because it's an established delivery system. The soil and water conservation districts have been in place since the Dust Bowl. There are hundreds of units of government out there that know what they're doing and are in touch with a local resource. They've been establishing local water management plans for decades. They embrace a watershed approach in order to address water quality issues. And they really are the best mechanism to deliver on-the-ground implementation from the legacy amendment, including outdoor heritage funds as well as clean water funds. So I want to tell you a little bit about some of the programs that we have. One of the main foundational pieces of our organization is the Conservation Delivery Program. This is the grant program that provides funding to all of the soil and water conservation districts that are out there. It provides about a third of the funding, base funding for their organization. Goes out to 90 soil and water conservation districts. The conservation districts are really that face of conservation in the state of Minnesota. They're the ones that sit down with local landowners in order to walk the farm, determine what's going on with the resource and their land, and provide all different types of opportunities and technical support in order for conservation to get done. They're elected. There's 5 members for each soil and water conservation district. They have no taxing authority, so they are reliant on both the state's contribution as well as the county contribution. And because they've been out there and existed for so long, they really are the primary delivery system for the cost share program, working on the ground with landowners, feedlot water quality grants, the Clean Water Fund. They also work on our RIM program, the Reinvest in Minnesota program.
Excuse me, Ms. Blackburn. First of all, we do have a quorum, members, and we have a question. Representative Paul Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blackburn, I was going to ask this question the other day but didn't have time. On your first bullet point up there, 90 SWCD districts, there's only 87 counties, so how does the math work with that?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, there are several that are of our counties that are very, very large, and so they're split, like St. Louis County, Otter Tail County. So those are split. And there's one more that off the top of my head I can't remember.
Representative Anderson?
Polk.
Okay. Ms. Blackburn.
Okay, as far as the projects that we work on working with these local units of government, we do a lot of on-the-ground getting things done as far as riparian buffers, grass waterways, manure management facilities. In the last 5 years, we have, through this local delivery system, installed about 18,000 different practices. The focus of these practices is to keep the water on the land so that we maintain hydrology, maintain healthy soils. We know that soils really are going to determine everything from the amount of agriculture that we can do and the sustainability of it, as well as our clean water. We work towards reducing pollutants into groundwater and surface water. We try to ensure that there's biological diversity with all of our projects, and we maintain stream integrity. Those are the 5 primary focuses of all of our grants that we put out there. We also do a tremendous amount of work in flood disaster recovery assistance. Wherever there's a flood, it's great to have that delivery system that's already in place so that immediate needs can be addressed. And this has happened throughout the state, both in the Red River Valley, throughout the southern part of the state, and a major, major effort in the southeast in 2007 through, actually right now, we're still cleaning up some of the projects down there. The cost share program has been established since 1977, and this is the program that goes out directly to SWCDs. They're the only groups, local unit of government, that receive these funds. Up to 75% of the cost share funds that go out to counties must be put to project costs. The additional amount is used for the staff resources for implementation and technical assistance. These projects must address high-priority erosion concerns or sediment control projects. Some examples of them are native buffers, feedlots. We also have a cooperative weed management program that allows us to address weeds and invasive species on more of a geographical scale than on a jurisdictional scale. All of these dollars leverage the USDA federal program. In the state of Minnesota, have a tremendous relationship with the federal program, both through the NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the Farm Service Agency. Brings in about $140 million to the state every year We package that along with the state programs and make sure that we make that conservation dollar go as far as possible. Through the last biennium, our current biennium, the clean water funds that we have, we received about $44 million to do on-the-ground projects. We received about $24 million to do on-the-ground projects. And in your packet of information, there's an 11 by 17 foldout that highlights some of the projects that we've done with our clean water fund. On the inside, what you'll see is that there's just an example of all different types of projects scattered throughout the state. Many of them are in farm areas. Many of them are for farm practices. One of them on the left-hand side that you'll see the fourth box down, that's one of them that I'm particularly interested in and want to make sure I follow up on. It's the Lincoln SWCD Verde Wellhead Protection Project. And this is working directly with farmers in a very sensitive groundwater area to make sure that they're working on precision ag, doing soil samples, and only applying the nutrients needed in order to still maintain the productivity while decreasing the amount of nitrates that are leaching into groundwater. They're providing incentives, almost kind of like an insurance policy, to make sure that this works for the farmer as well as for the water supply city. Now, if this all works and if they can stop some of the nitrates from going into groundwater, it's going to save that city from putting in about $8 million worth of nitrate treatment systems in their plant. So these are the kinds of things that we think are important to talk about, that ag is contributing to all types of clean water, not just surface water, but groundwater. You'll also see on the back side of this sheet at the top the amount of funds that we have put into riparian buffers, about $7 million in riparian buffers for clean water. And under that, you'll see feedlot grants. We had about $4 million for feedlot grants. We put in 97 feedlots, averaged about $40,000 per feedlot. So there's a sampling of all of the types of projects. You also have this little 3x5 card. If you go to our website, you will see on the very front page the Legacy logo. If you click on that link, you will go to a map of the state of Minnesota, and there you can scan all of the different Clean Water Fund projects that are scattered throughout the state. Most likely there's one located near you, and you can see the results of the Legacy Amendment. This is a little bit more about the feedlot upgrades. The feedlots, the money was directed towards feedlots in a riparian area and must be less than 300 animal units. One of the other projects and program areas we work on at Bowser is we work on conservation drainage projects and assistance. On the map, you'll see everything that's highlighted in red are areas of the state that are drained with public drainage. There's about 21,000 miles of public drainage systems in the state. We try to get out there and work with the public drainage authorities as well as the benefited farm land owners, and try to do some retrofits along those drainage systems in order to reduce the amount of pollutants that are going into those drainage systems. If you're familiar at all with drainage law, you know that no funds that are generated from the drainage authorities can be used for water quality purposes. So we need to get at those types of projects through other funding. Last year we had in this current biennium, a very, very little amount of money available for this, only about $300,000. We had requests in excess of $101,300,000. Lost in my numbers today. Sorry about that. It's like Monday for me. I know you guys were here yesterday, but I wasn't.
Well, Ms. Blackburn, I think it's must be about 11:30 at night in Laos right now, so I can comprehend as well.
Oh, is that where you have come back from?
Please proceed.
So there's a high demand for these types of projects and practices. One of the requirements in order to receive any of these funds is that if you're going to do conservation drainage, we want to make sure that there's some kind of evaluation of the project results on that project, and we also want to make sure that there's an outreach effort for that. We'd like to make sure that these are adopted throughout the drainage system in areas particularly where there are water quality issues. In our clean water funding request for this year, we have requested $2 million for the conservation drainage projects. all of this can't happen unless there's technical assistance available out there for the farmers to go to, for landowners to go to. Technical assistance by way of their Soil and Water Conservation District primarily is the face of conservation. So we do provide technical assistance funding out there as well. You have an example here on the left-hand side of folks working out in the field, and an example of one of our clean water stories. We packaged some money together to address fecal issues, both manure management situations as well as SSTS, all different types of programs in the southeast. There is a TMDL, a total maximum daily load, impaired water down there, and so we have a bunch of grant funding that went towards manure management, feedlot upgrades, but we needed to make sure that there was the technical assistance to get it done. So we packaged some money for them to make sure that we can get all of those projects taken care of as quickly as possible. One of the other programs that we offer, particularly throughout the southwestern part of the state as well as the western corridor, is our Reinvest in Minnesota, our RIM program. Our RIM program has been in place now for 25 years. Through that time, we've acquired over 230,000 acres of RIM easements. These are primarily areas where we restore wetlands both for flood retention as well as water quality benefits. There are areas that have been previously drained that we work to restore the hydrology. We have been very successful leveraging the federal dollar on this program. The NRCS has a wetland restoration program that leverages about $1.50 federal dollars for every $1 of the state. So we've been very successful on that program, and some of the results from that program are also included in the other 11 by 17 flyer that you have. That's called the Reinvest in Minnesota Wetlands Reserve Program Leveraging Project. And in that, you'll see a scattering of all of the projects that have been put in place, as well as the dollars that we've leveraged for the state to get wetlands restored. On the backside, you'll see an example of one of the projects that was put into Jackson County. It's about a 110-acre project, including those wetlands that have been restored. So there's some information there for you about the different types of projects. The RIM projects have mainly been funded historically through bonding dollars. Here's an example. This was is by Lake Waconia. It's actually just being developed right now. It was one of the sites where the federal government, the NRCS program, came and celebrated their 2 millionth acre of wetlands restored in the state. This had a direct discharge to Lake Waconia, certainly a water resource that we're concerned about. So what we did was we worked with that landowner in order to determine how they would like to restore that wetland, so it not only provides for some flood control, but it also helps treat some of those pollutants before they discharge into Lake Waconia.
Excuse me, we do have a question. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Blackburn, that looks familiar. Is that the former sod farm?
Ms. Blackburn.
Across the road from Lake Waconia?
Excuse me. Ms. Blackburn.
I'm guessing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski, I'm looking at my executive director over there, John Jasky, and he's giving me a vigorous head nod yes. That is correct.
Representative Szymanski? No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Ms. Blackburn, please.
What you'll also see on this graph is that we have done some research to determine whether or not these RIM easements actually account to an environmental benefit. There are three different subwatersheds that were monitored. The subwatershed of the West Fork Beaver Creek had the most wetlands restored closest to the drainage channel. And what we see there is the biological index, the index of the water quality and all the little critters that live in there, greatly increased the closer to that riparian area, the more wetlands there were. So we do know that there's a lot of great research out there.
Little critters.
Little critters.
Gotcha.
In the last, in the current biennium, we had appropriations for riparian buffers and wellhead protection out of the Clean Water Fund. Again, that's in the information that was provided to you. We had about $7 million for riparian buffers. We targeted this towards existing CRP land. And what that means is the federal program has already gone in there and done the practice. They've restored that riparian area. They've done the planting, and it's already established. So we went in and put the conservation easement on top of it for long-term protection. We also had $2 million that was provided in order to work on conservation easements in very sensitive wellhead areas. All of this information is available on our website. What you see here is a map of Barnesville and the wellhead protection area around Barnesville. The bright red area is all the land that is highly vulnerable to groundwater sensitivity. So that's where we're looking to acquire those easements in order to reduce the amount of nitrates and other contaminants that are brought into groundwater. One of the other programs that we have, along with our conservation drainage program, we are the oversight authority for drainage authorities. Again, there's about 21,000 miles of drainage ditches in the state. We work with a drainage work group in order to come up with consensus recommendations that will address some of the issues in drainage law to make sure that it continually looks at new issues and that there are improvements into the implementation of that program. Some of the proceedings that we look at, that the drainage work group looks at, that sometimes come to the legislature include the redetermination of benefits, repairs and improvements on ditch system. We also receive all of the drainage buffer records. Every year the drainage authorities have to report to us the amount of buffers that have been installed as required by law. Just to give you an example of the drainage work group membership, it's a pretty incredible group of folks that sit down on all sides of the issue and work through some very, very sensitive types of issues that come out in the local level, and they develop a consensus about it. And we manage that. Al Kane, our chief engineer, and you'll see some of those recommendations have been brought forward in the past, and they continue to work. So those are some of the projects and the summaries of some of the things that we work on in the landscape, particularly in the ag area. As we move forward, we want to continue to tell that story about what ag is doing in the clean water world and making sure that our environment is sustainable in the future. So we're trying to determine the on-the-ground outcomes for the projects that we're working on. We've proposed this before. We're proposing it again. It hasn't been funded. In our clean water funding package this year, we are asking for funding in order to determine the on-the-ground outcomes, such as doing tillage transect surveys and soil erosion surveys. We want to see what's really happening out there, because we know that the quality of the land is what determines the quality of water. We do a lot of monitoring of water in this state. What we haven't been monitoring is the health of the land, and we would like the opportunity to do that. By doing that, we want to learn about adoption rates. What are the barriers? How do we remove the barriers? How do we address what is stopping conservation from going in the ground? We also want to make sure that we verify pollution reduction estimates. For every single one of our practices that go in place, the conservationist that's working on it has to determine the outcomes, the estimated outcomes. We want to work on verifying whether our equations are correct, so we're doing some on-the-ground research with the University of Minnesota to make sure that we verify those, so that when we report our outcomes to you, such as the amount of soil erosion that we've prevented, that those are correct. So we're trying to build great science, determine our outcomes, and we also want to determine that there's the way that we can properly address the amount of funding and projects that are going on the ground. Currently, the federal government does not allow us to share any of the projects that have been put in place through the ag community. The data is treated much differently than Minnesota data. Minnesota data is open to everybody. Federal data is closed. We are working on a information sharing agreement with the NRCS so that they will give to us the amount of projects, the amount of practice dollars that have gone on the ground, but no identification of landowner name. It will just be from a micro watershed. We'll know the amount of funding and the amount of projects in a micro watershed so that we can report fully to you how the federal dollars is teamed up with the state dollar in order to get those practices and projects on the ground. We do believe that there has not been adequate reporting of that information so far. So both us and NRCS are excited about this. The new state conservationist, Don Ballone, is working actively on this so that hopefully in the near future, meaning in months from now, we'll be able to really complete the whole picture of conservation and ag. That's about all that I had for you. I do want to have Leanne come and just give a minute or two update about comment about the soil and water conservation districts and how they assist getting conservation on the ground.
Okay. Please state your name for the record, please.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Leanne Buck. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. It's an honor and privilege to be here today and to talk about soil and water districts. Julie did a great overview from the state perspective. And what our organization, we're very strong on the sentiment of grassroots conservation. We are the districts that serve the community by coordinating both technical and financial assistance for landowners. I like to think of us as boots on the ground, or another way you can think of us is we're your infantry. We're out there on a day-to-day basis with the landowners implementing conservation practices. We are local units of government. You have charged us with different practices and different authorities. We also have, each soil and water district has 5 local citizen board members. So again, to me, that's a strong component of the accountability. Many of them are farmers. Many of them are innovators in conservation best management practices. If a project comes along, I see Department of Ag will be up. Many of those innovative practices that they're looking at, the volunteers sometimes tend to be soil and water district supervisors that put those practices in place to see what's happening, how they can make things better. As Julie said, partnerships are key. And with our partnerships, the first partnership I guess I want to compliment is the landowner. That is our most important partner in all of the work that we do. Again, it's landowners coming into the soil and water district offices looking for technical assistance, looking for financial assistance, asking the questions, how can I make my landscape better? How can I protect my water? And we can give them options. The other partners, obviously, are Julie here representing the Board of Water and Soil Resources. To me, that's very key. Also, we are with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency. Many times, majority of our districts are co-located in those USDA service centers. So chances are, if you did talk to somebody, you might not know if they're a federal employee or if they're a state employee. And I think that's a compliment to the way we work together. You don't always see that across different jurisdictional boundaries. The other piece, county government's key. They're the ones that pay for our operations. They're the ones that pay for that technical assistance. And again, we really appreciate the partnerships we have with county government. And again, like I said, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, they take all of our individual grassroots action and put it together and share that information back with you. So again, they're a key player. And the one thing I guess I don't want to forget saying, Minnesota, many times a lot of federal dollars go out of the state and you have less of a return of federal dollars coming in. This is one area that's the opposite. We are one of the leaders of bringing in USDA federal dollars into the state, and the reason is because of that infrastructure that you've invested with the soil and water districts, with Bowser's. We're leveraging programs. We're leveraging millions of dollars of conservation funds that come into the state, and we're providing more options for landowners so they can better serve their community and also their agricultural needs. So at the end of the day, landowner walks in, we're the place that they can ask questions, we can have the best management practices, we can say here's an idea, you could do this wetland restoration, you could do this feedlot, here's how you could do it. And the other thing too that I guess I really want to emphasize is the landowners are contributing to the cost of these projects. So there's a huge contribution coming in from agricultural landowners, and we don't take that lightly. We appreciate everything that they're putting forward. They've got a stake in the game, and we really appreciate the landowners in Minnesota across the state that are working with us. So with that, I'll open it to any questions.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was it Lori?
Leanne Buck.
Thank you. I apologize for being late, Mr. Chair. I had some constituents up there, and I apologize for my voice as well. I've been battling some bronchitis, but... Ms. Buck, I want to. I attend as many of my soil and water conservation districts in my district, And they are remarkable people. They really do a remarkable job. And one of the things, they just did a huge project up in, actually represent Howell's district over at the Pelican Lake at Breezy Point. And you're nodding your head, yes, you know about this. But the point that I'm going to make is not many people knew about that. I mean, they're again a secret. They don't tout. They don't blow their horn enough. You know, when I go, although they're the directors, the five directors remind me all the time that the soil and water conservation districts are the best return on our bucks that we can get investment wise. But the projects that they do are remarkable. I mean, they are truly remarkable. There was this runoff project that going into Pelican Lake that was a huge problem for many, many years, and the Soil and Water Conservation District got it taken care of. And I said to them, you need to blow your horn. You need to make sure that the state of Minnesota know what you have done for our area and our clean water. So I want to pass on to you also that as you folks do those projects, and I know that the connection to Bowser, I know the connection to the county governments, sometimes because you don't blow your own horns enough, you know, those are some of the folks that maybe they think, okay, well, they're not really, we can move it. They used to be in the USDA up in Baxter, and now they've gotten moved and et cetera. So it's easy to sometimes say, okay, let's either downsize or not, you know, or whatever, because people don't know about what you're doing enough. So I want to encourage you to make sure that people know what you're doing more and more and more. Thank you.
So, and best return on your buck, Ms. Buck, no pun intended. So,
never heard that one.
Ms. Buck, would you like to comment?
Representative Hamilton, Representative Ward, you would be a great spokesperson, so thank you so much for the kind words that you've said about the Soil and Water District. We realize that we're kind of a quiet, one of the best-kept secrets. We even have these issues nationally as well, because our group tends to be, we move from project to project, get it in the ground, and move forward. So we're continuing, and if you notice the sheet that I'm putting out, a lot of times even our folks will put before and after pictures of projects. And what I'm really trying to represent with our organization, encourage our members, that they also talk about that infrastructure, that citizen board member, that technical assistance. And then the other thing, too, that's very helpful is the way Bowser's been collecting our stories and the information, too. And so we want to utilize Bowser as well as to assist. So between Bowser, our association, our local districts, we'll continue to work on that. Thank you.
Ms. Blackburn.
I did have one more thing that I wanted to comment on because I think it's important. In December, both Leanne and I went to a national conference, the National Leadership Conference, which was comprised of five different groups, including the Natural Resource Conservation Districts, the State Association of All Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the State Agency Association. So I got a scholarship to go because, of course, we aren't allowed to travel out of state. Leanne went. We were asked, I submitted a request for us to talk about what's happening in Minnesota with this flood of new conservation dollars while we're, you know, facing such a state deficit, and how do we manage all that. They put us on as an hour start of their entire, one of their entire days, and that was used as the foundation of the rest of the day's work. And I was really, really proud of Minnesota and what we have in this state. When we went and gave our national presentation of the national audience, all 50 states were there, the federal agencies, the chief of the Natural Resource Conservation was there, Chief White. We had so many people coming up to us afterwards saying, wow, Minnesota, you are just amazing. And we believe that. And it was kind of hard to go in there and think, I was thinking, wow, there's been so many bad news stories. But we came away from there really proud of the conservation efforts that we're doing in this state.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to hear about these projects. And as a former SWCD supervisor, I'm proud of what you're doing. I somewhat rhetorical to Representative Ward's comment there. I'm not sure what it takes to get the Star Trib or Pioneer Press pay attention to some of this stuff, but you know, perhaps one day they'll understand that the work that was done, I think the Pelican Lake project, that keeps the water cleaner down here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And there's a lot of these projects upstream and coming from all parts of Minnesota. And whatever it takes, Mr. Chair, to get some press on this, I'm for it. So,
Representative Purcell, if you and Representative Ward would like to put a letter together, I'll sign on to it and we can submit it. That would be a start as well. So you're absolutely right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for coming in today. What I'm interested in is the nexus between flood control and the various projects that you do as far as water quality and land conservation. I think there's great potential for us to bring these sorts of efforts together, and I'm just interested in your comments as to whether that is feasible in today's structure of funding and agencies, and if there's anything that you might suggest that we do that make that work a little better. I think there's great opportunities for us to temporarily hold water on the landscape to gain both water quality and land quality benefits, and at the same time potentially impact some of the flooding problems that we have here in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I absolutely agree. I believe, speaking for Bowser, that we agree that there is quite a nexus for us to take as a leverage point for the issues of flooding, as well as the types of conservation projects that we are working on. Our RIM projects certainly retain water on the land. Most of those are for permanent wetlands, permanent wetland restoration. But the types of conservation drainage projects that we're looking at here, you see an example of trying to have some controlled drainage from tile drainage, so that we can hold the water on the land a little bit after storm events and meter that water out so that you are still getting it off in time for crops to grow. You're not killing off those crops, but you're holding that water back just enough so that you aren't having the erosive stream bank problems or any of the flooding problems. We need to do a lot more of this. There's a lot of land. There's a lot of solutions out there. What we need are those technical experts, the people to get out there to talk to landowners, and the money to get those conservation projects put on the ground so that we can hold water longer.
Representative Torkelson.
Sorry. That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Members, we have questions from Representative Anderson, Representative Hansen, Representative Poppy. We're going to spend about 7 more minutes on here if we could. So, Representative Anderson, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Buck, a question about with CRP signups becoming fewer and further in between, has that changed kind of your emphasis on some of the types of projects you do and maybe the number of projects that go through your offices statewide?
Sure, Representative Torkelson, Chair Hamilton, Representative Anderson. Yes, the way I like to look at it is the Conservation Reserve Program, which is a federal program run through the Farm Service Agency. One of the things that's nice about Minnesota is we then have something to offer them with the RIM program. That could be longer term if they don't want to do the CRP. Because they're having fewer signups, it'll start looking at if the projects come out of the CRP contract, and that it will turn into what we call working land projects. So are there sediment control basins that we can put in on that land? Are there terraces? Are there other things that we can do? Are there wildlife habitat incentive type of programs that we can put on those same lands that are now coming out? So, yeah, we'll see a balance of if they do come out, then what we would call it working land conservation practices. So you look at a different slew of practices that could help that landowner.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Buck and Ms. Blackburn, can you give us a little idea of demand on dollars that are out there for wetland restoration program? Because we had a veto of $25 million in bonding last year, and we had $10 million that came in during the flood, but you've got signups going on now. Historically, have we had demand from landowners here that exceeds the amount of dollars that we have? And then secondly, how many more years under the current Farm Bill is there where the WRP is funded at the way it is now?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that's a very good question. As far as our RIM WRP signups, we have had certainly more than double the amount of requests that we have had funding available. And that continues no matter what signup we've had. We've always had an extraordinary amount of interest in the projects. As far as the federal programs through the current federal farm bill, we do expect that there will be a new federal farm bill coming out next year, 2013. Currently, we have coming to the state automatically every year $25 million in WRP funds. We also have, at the end of every federal fiscal year, a bump more. And we never really know how much that's going to be. There's an allocation that's brought out to all states. And if other states haven't used it towards the end of the federal fiscal year, they turn it back for redistribution among those states that can use it. So we've had about $50 million coming to the state for the last several years from the federal program that we tie up with ours. We did not get the bonding last year. But the time is fairly critical because we do believe that in the future we are not going to have the same amount of WRP funds coming through the federal farm bill.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Blackburn, so then the more we authorize, the more we get because the other states can't use it. So for matching dollars, if we authorize more funding, whether it's from constitutional dollars or bonding dollars, you have the capacity to have willing landowners to implement high-quality projects as far as the eye can see.
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that's correct. And if you look at the information that is provided in our handout, we do know that there's also a tremendous amount of local economic benefit as well. Not only are we matching the federal dollar at close to one and a half per state dollar, this is all in the state goals to restore these wetland areas. So the sooner we do it, you know, with this federal dollar, the faster we meet our goal. But we have information on this handout on the left-hand side, the RIM handout on the left-hand side, about the amount of jobs that are created and the amount of economic output that's created for every for all of the projects that are combined here. When we get these projects on the ground, it takes local contractors, local backhoe operators, seed providers, installers, all different kinds of folks in order to get these projects on the ground. We also know that it provides some financial incentive for that landowner that may go into investment in farm equipment, new barns, whatever it may be. So we do know that there's a lot of economic activity that's generated from this. So it's not just about leveraging that federal dollar. It's what it means to the state when it is provided out to those local counties, those local landowners. The RIM programs keep the land in private conservation. It's in private landowners, so it doesn't become state property. It remains on the tax rolls. It can still be used for conservation projects, including, like as Leanne said, the working lands. We're working on trying to find ways to have biofuels harvested or flash grazing or all different types of practices that could still go on the easement. So there are many different opportunities from the easement program.
Ms. Buck.
Representative Hamilton, Representative Hansen. I just want to add, we've been, as an association, very closely monitoring the federal activities that are happening in the state. And I was on a conference call with one of my peers from another state, and I was advocating for the WRP program. And she had said, well, I think we had to return money back. It's not that popular in our state. And I said, we probably took that money. So, again, it's but we are concerned with the continuing resolution, some of the federal budget deficit type of things that are taking place. So there is money available, but they will be looking at that, I'm sure. So, again, how we can manage that this year and going into the next couple of years is really key for our association in leveraging the federal dollars.
Hey, members, we're going to wrap this up here in a couple minutes. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to Representative Torkelson's question about RIM dollars, because certainly in my district, that's very important, and we actually are very appreciative of the RIM dollars. I represent Austin and southern Minnesota, and our water doesn't flow through Minneapolis-St. Paul, but it certainly flows into Iowa. And as you recall, the Cedar River flooding that happened recently in Iowa, they're very concerned about what we're doing. So RIM dollars help us. We actually have kind of a two- or three-prong approach, and RIM dollars being part of that. We get bonding dollars, always appreciated through the state, to be able to mitigate the flooding either through building barriers or through buying out property. And we have a local option sales tax that helps us with the match that we have. So I think RIM dollars are important. And the other thing I wanted to say about RIM dollars, farms will be flooded no matter when the rains come. The farms will be flooded. So this gives the opportunity for the farmers to actually have a little bit more control over whether or not they want their farms flooded, and just to kind of go through the process for insurance claims and whatever, or to actually say, you know what, we're gonna participate and we're going to help to solve the problem. And it's been very successful and very well used. And I would just always say, you know, RIM dollars are important, at least in my part of the state.
Thank you. Representative Schmansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, water quality is important to all of us. And we've talked just a little bit about animal agriculture and feedlot runoff today. And my question will kind of get around to the point of, you know, on a smaller scale, some of these, you know, small animal feedlots, well, they don't have a big confinement area and the resources to build, you know, reservoirs or manure lagoons and so forth. How does the Board of Soil and Water assist the farmers with the small feedlots in being able to control their runoff water without, you know, costing having a project that costs so much that they throw up their hands and they just say, well, we'll just get out of animal agriculture because we can't afford to come into compliance?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schmansky, the small feedlot owner, I think, has a great resource in going to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and working with the Joint Power Board technicians and engineers. We have a program in this state that is been built from Department of Ag as well as NRCS, Bowser, and the U of M called the MinFarm program, and it actually is a computer program that you look through, put in all of the elevations, the size of the feedlot area, and you run a model to determine the runoff and where the runoff goes and its proximity to a discharge point. And we can go through on any one of these projects and look at something as simple as redesigning where the gutters go and making sure that the runoff doesn't go across the manure holding area so that it's directed away from it. So we can try to find very, very low-cost projects that reduce the amount of impact that they have. For any one of our farmers that goes through the feedlot upgrade, they have to get it to a point of zero discharge. And the goal is to make sure that they don't spend any more than $3,000 out of pocket. So that's why the conservation dollars are so important for the feedlot practices. There's been a tremendous amount of work that's been done in this area, and I've gone out onto a lot of feedlots myself and just looked at something as simple as redirection of gutters and what it does. So we work really hard to make sure that it is not going to take away from the small farmer in order to upgrade their feedlot.
Well, thank you. Thank you to the testifiers. I would like to stress to the members here as well, I know last legislative session when I served on the Environment Committee, Ms. Blackburn and many of my local reps, whether it was from the Huron Lake Watershed District, they provided me with information as far as the actual results on what pollution was reduced, whether we're talking about TMDLs, phosphorus reductions, et cetera, et cetera. It was extremely valuable to have that information right in front of me so I can answer many questions in the Environment Committee. So thank you so much for what you do and for your testimony. And with that, we'll move on to the next ones. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We are going to switch up the schedule here a little bit. We do have a few people that traveled. So we're going to call up the reps from the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. And we're going to talk about precision agriculture. We spoke to the department. They're okay with that, moving them around on the agenda as well. So if you would please state your name for the record and who you represent, and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bond, representing the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. Our members are the folks in the co-op agronomy businesses and the independent ag retailers throughout the state of Minnesota that supply the crop inputs for producers. And so we have as well members who are the distributors and producers of the crop inputs, which would be the seed, the fertilizer, and the pesticides, and also the equipment that supplies those. And as well, we have as our members, the certified crop advisors. So we're the folks that help the farmers in getting their crop inputs properly.
Welcome.
We have a couple of members represented today who are going to do a presentation on what is production agriculture doing for clean water. And I'll go ahead and let them introduce themselves.
Okay.
My name is Paul Trichka. I work for CHS in Grand Meadow, Minnesota, area that Representative Pops from.
Welcome.
My name is Craig Jorgensen. I work for AGCO Corporation, one of the manufacturers of this variable rate application equipment.
Welcome, and I see that you're able to make it up here despite the snowstorm. So thank you. Welcome.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Mr. Chairman and the representatives for granting us time to be here today. Our presentation here fits in very well with the presentation that was just preceding us. Ms. Blackburn had stated about what goes on the land eventually, or the quality of what goes on with the land will affect the quality of the water. And what I'm going to talk about is how we as ag business affect and work with, when we work with our producers, how we work and help improve and work with the quality of the water. We work with, and you hear a lot of different terms. I heard the previous speaker talk about precision ag. It'll go under different terms. You'll hear variable rate technology. It's just another word, site-specific applications. Another thing that they're talking about, and basically what these terms, whatever they're using, we're looking at using the right source, being the fertilizer, whether it be commercial fertilizer or manure, the right rate of product applied at the right time of year, and also in the right place, or as it's also known as BMPs, best management practices. And our objective here is for optimum crop production for the producer and also to protect the environment. And one of the things as an agronomist that we do is we manage nutrients. We manage the nutrients, the plant food, in other words, that goes into growing the crop. And there are 16 essential elements that the crop needs to produce, to live, to generate, and to provide us with food. Some of the practices of BMPs, or best management practices, include things anywhere from pre-plant fertilizer application, where the fertilizer is applied and incorporated into the soil so it's not sitting on top and subject to leaching or movement across if there's a heavy rainstorm. Utilizing some of the tests that the land-grant universities have developed, such as the pre-sidress nitrogen test. Enhancing fertilizers, taking fertilizers and utilizing them, and working with some of the different manufacturers to improve their efficiency. Fertilizer incorporation, use of variable rate equipment, which my colleague Craig will talk about here shortly, split applications of certain nutrients. Nutrients like nitrogen tend to be very mobile in the soil. Identifying which soil types are subject to leaching and things like that, and then recommending to the producer that this is the practice that we utilize. And as we also go to advanced technology, things like chlorophyll sensors or optical sensors that identify the greenness of the crop to treat areas that need additional nutrients versus crops or parts of plants that are adequate. Our goal is to utilize nutrients, and when we utilize nutrients, keep in mind that fertilizers are generated from energy, natural gas, these type of things. We look at how, when we utilize these products, utilize them in a very efficient format. And as we hear what's going on in the world today, we're looking at all these things, how they affect what the price the growers are paying for fertilizer, the price the consumers are paying for food. So we look at how these things become very efficient. We look at also improving and reducing the ecological footprint by helping increase organic matter. Some of the work that our land-grant universities, the University of Minnesota, Dan Kaiser, has done in the last few years has looked at site-specific, or putting nutrients in the right place at the right time. Yeah, you should be able to see that. You have areas there. Sulfur is a nutrient that's very vital to a crop. What Dan is doing where Dr. Kaiser is doing is identifying areas in the field that are low in organic matter. They're applying the nutrient in those areas, and it's raising a higher yield, bringing more organic matter there, which, as you talk to people from the NRCS, conservation tillage, that's one of the things. How do we improve our organic matter, which helps sequester carbon? And with all of this, our goal is to improve water quality, much as the presenters before us talked about. And we want to be part of the solution. Thank you. We're looking to improve and maintain soil productivity to meet the expectations for future. Many of our growers look at saying, how are we going to sustain our land for our sons and daughters down the road? You know, we want to make sure that that's there down the road. Another aspect is, you know, being ag is in a rural environment. Creation of skilled jobs. These are just some of the skilled jobs that looking at variable rate or precision ag tends to bring to a local community. When a location brings in, says we want to get involved in precision ag, now we're looking at bringing in employees that are highly trained, highly skilled, from precision ag specialist to GIS analyst. And also, as Craig's going to talk about here in the future, how we look at, when we look at precision ag, that, you know, we generate a need for equipment, which leads to building and manufacturing of equipment, which again is job related. The steps that we follow in our process. Number one, we gather data. That's one of the first things we do when we look at this to determine what are we going to apply on that field. We do a lot of soil testing. Soil testing being taking a soil probe, going down, much like if you go to the doctor, they do a battery of tests on you to say, okay, where are you at? What's your heart rate? What's your BP? We do the same thing with the soil. We measure your phosphorus levels of potassium and a number of those different nutrients. From there, we lay that out on a map. We identify sensitive features where there's streams. We look at the soil survey. We look at the type of soil that's not there. You know, is there exposed bedrock? Is there water that's near surface water, near 12 inches of the surface? So all those factors come into play is when we make a recommendation. And then from there, we then look at, say, okay, how do we incorporate buffer zones around maybe a stream or something like that? Soil tests are taken at those spots. Each one of those dots represents a location of a spot. It is geo-referenced via the satellite systems. So anybody with a handheld little Garmin, they can go back out to that same spot, walk it, say, okay, I want to see what that spot is, look at the crop, and so forth. And this just shows we're looking at replacing the nutrients that have been removed by the crop. This is just a map showing a yield map of a farm. The dark areas, the brown areas, tend to signify areas that are very high yielding. So those areas are removing more nutrients because they got a higher yielding area versus the bluish areas, and those areas are yielding a lot lower. And our goal is to say, okay, what's going on there? How do we identify, and can we do something about it? So based on the results of those soil tests, we look at the spatial variability of the nutrients. Now, spatial variability is a big term, but all it does is says how the nutrients vary across the landscape. In this case, we're looking at phosphorus. Phosphorus is a nutrient that garners a lot of attention in the media, from runoff and different things to algae blooms. This is a farm that was tested in 2005 for phosphorus. The soil test is measured in parts per million, but you can see right next to the building site, or to the right of the building site, that area. Over the years, the producer, there was a dairy operation there, that's where all the manure was spread. And if you grew up on a farm, you may remember when Dad said, go out there, spread the manure, and it was like yesterday, you didn't get very far from the barn. Now, those areas are testing very high, extremely high, and they become a concern. So because of that, we can take that information, we can create an application map, we can look at all these factors from soil types to fertility levels, yield goals, a number of factors, the commodity price, the input price, and make a map, a recommendation, or a prescription of how we're going to apply fertilizer to that field to best protect the environment, that we're not overdoing areas, and then we maximize production for the producer. And then we go out there, we make that application with one of these machines that can apply multiple products in one pass, and Craig will talk about those here in a minute. The map on the right shows the actual application. So when you look at the map on the left, that's our soil test. Look at just to the right of the building site, that's the area on the very left, that little indentation, that's testing very high. The map on the right is where we're actually applying phosphorus fertilizer. You can see through this technology and the use of geographical information systems, the satellites and all that, the area that's showing up as gray, we're not putting any more phosphorus there because it's already high. And through land grant testing, we've identified saying that we're not going to lose any crop yield there. So why keep putting more nutrients there? Versus, like you get down on the bottom part of the map or up on the top part of the map, those areas are testing very low. So we're actually applying, again, according to recommendations, a lot higher amount of phosphorus there because it is testing low. And to show, when you look at this stuff and you sit there and you go through this over time, the map on the left, again, was the test for phosphorus taken in 2005. When we retested this in 2009, you can see that the phosphorus levels, now, when I look at this map, look, the one on the left, you see those very bright green areas. Look at the areas on the right. They're starting to get not as dark green anymore. We're starting to get rid of all the greens. We're starting to become more yellow. So we're bringing those phosphorus levels next to the building down, and we're starting to spread the nutrients out over more of the field and utilizing the nutrients in a more efficient fashion. And we look at this with nitrogen as well. We do variable rate nitrogen applications. Nitrogen is one of the key nutrients for production of crops, for corn, wheat, those crops. And without it, crops can't grow. Corn can't grow. The red bars, these are just four different fields that a colleague of mine and myself put together. We just picked four fields. Looking at a flat rate application and that's the old standard way we've done things, just applying a certain rate. Now when we look at variable rate applications, which are based off of phosphorus, there's some nitrogen in there, we look at yield goals, things like that, we can see that we're starting to reduce the amount of nitrogen used, yet without. And in this case, we were looking at a 15% reduction in the amount of nitrogen used on those farms without sacrificing yield. So we're becoming more efficient. Some of the challenges we faced over the years, prior to the Y2K year, technology was erratic, computers were erratic, satellites, all those things, you know. We've made tremendous strides in that. Education of the growers, education of good students coming out of the universities. It does take time. One of the things, when you sit down with the producer, this is a very timely process. It isn't just like the old ways when we used to do things. It's what do you want, here it is. To look and evaluate these fields and start identifying sensitive features and looking at these things, it does take time. It does take patience by us at the ag retail level and patience by the grower. And a lot of times buying patterns of growers make a difference. Well, that's not the way Dad did it, you know, and many of you have been there, you know, seen that happen. Can it help Also with protein in wheat, it's been documented that it can improve sugar content of sugar beets. From there, we look at creating as-applied maps. An as-applied map is basically a documentation of what was applied. So I can, and a lot of times, the growers and the applicator drivers come in and they'll ask me, Paul, which direction was I going when I was spreading this field? And by looking at the time that was stamped on that map, I can tell them, oh, you were going from east to west, and at what speed, and this is what you were applying. And if they had a problem, I could say, this is where you ran out of product. These can be used to document some of the government programs, the EQIP, nutrient management plans, the CSP, etc. And they also can be used for documentation of applications for canning crops. I have a lot of growers come to me and they from Seneca Foods, they'll say, Paul, I need this stated. This is what was applied here, certifying that this is what was used on canning peas or sweet corn, because they need it for their operation. Ag business is, this whole process is going beyond us. We have, and like with some of the federal organizations, like the Bowser program and those have been around for years, the best management practices. We're starting to hear a lot of talk from industry associations, the Fertilizer Institute, the TFI, the IPNI, which stands for the International Plant Nutrition Institute. These are starting to do more work where they're actually promoting a program called the 4 R's. The NRCS and the TFI have entered into agreements to work together. And they're also at the Commodity Classic coming up here in March in Tampa, Florida. They're going to be unrolling this to the producers. They're going to be telling them. So the growers are going to be hearing a lot more about the 4 R's. And again, the 4 R's, and that's their little logo that they're using. They've coined the term. It's stewardship to improve ag production while minimizing environmental impacts, which benefits the water and air quality. And again, the 4 R's represent the use of the right source. Again, that's going to be whether it's commercial fertilizer, whether it's a manure source, the right rate, the right time, and the right place. And the framework is designed to increase production, improve the profitability of the producer, enhance environmental protection, and improve sustainability. And all of these work best when they're combined with multiple practices. And the multiple practices could be conservation tillage, the right seed, these kind of different things, utilizing some of the other programs that are out there.
Mr. Trishka, about 12 minutes including questions, just to give you a little bit of...
Thank you.
And with your testimony here, we are educated, we are professional, we are farmers. Thank you for this. This is, members... This is what it's all about, and we need to make sure that we do our part, our due diligence, to educate our colleagues as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I want to talk a little bit about the equipment that is being produced to meet these types of applications. There's two major manufacturers of variable rate pneumatic application equipment, and they're both located in Minnesota, one of them being AGCO Corporation, the other one being Case IH. There's also one major manufacturer of variable rate spinner applicators, which is located in Iowa, Highway Equipment. Approximately, there's about 56 units of these sold in the state of Minnesota just last year that can variably apply three or more fertilizer products simultaneously. Just to give you an idea of what this equipment costs compared to typical fertilizer equipment that can't do variable rate equipment, for non-variable rate application equipment, we're looking at spinners from $230,000 to $245,000 for a piece of equipment with a single compartment, an air spreader, $250,000 to $275,000. When you look at the variable rate application equipment, multiple bin spinner capable of three products is now up to $250,000, $260,000, and air pneumatic spreaders all the way from $290,000 to $365,000, depending upon the number of products that they're variably applying in one time. This is where the problem comes in as well, is that The non-variable rate application equipment can cover more acres per day because it is easier to tender, easier to get the product to that machine in a quicker amount of time. So they can cover more acres. Now, yes, they're not charging as much per acre with that equipment, but when you multiply it times the number of acres they're charging, the fertilizer dealer is still coming out a little bit ahead with the non-VRT equipment. And so it's harder to propel that type of technology. As you can see, you're looking at roughly $4,500 to $5,200 of income with the spinner or pneumatic spreader that is non-VRT. But when you look at the VRT equipment, we're charging more per acre, but we're covering fewer acres. So now we're down from $4,900 to $5,600 an acre as far as your potential income, depending upon the type of equipment. Just to go over a little bit the equipment that we're talking about, this is the variable rate spinner spreader that we're talking about. It's capable of applying two macronutrients and one micronutrient at the same time. Here's just a little bit of a diagram showing you the A and B compartments would be your macronutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. The C compartment there would be your micronutrient, whether that's sulfur or zinc or some other micronutrient that may be needed. And the location D there is where they're all dropped on together onto the spinner and spread out onto the soil. So each one of those compartments has the ability to variably apply that compartment as you cross in the field. This is the dry pneumatic variable rate piece of application equipment from Case IH. They're capable of applying one up to three different fertilizer products simultaneously, again with two macronutrient products, and then also the ability for one micronutrient product as well. It does have the ability to also put on liquid fertilizer at the same time that you can inject your herbicides into that also. AGCO also has a few different units for variable rate fertilizer. This one here showing one that's capable of one to three products. Again, two granular products for micronutrients and then one main compartment for macronutrients. And then we've got a spreader here that actually will do up to six different products of dry products, four macronutrient bins, two micronutrient bins. We can also spray at the same time with this unit, variably injecting the herbicides or micronutrients in a liquid form. There you can see a little better view of that machine from the top. You notice the four large bins. In the back, there's two micronutrient bins as well. The whole summary we're looking at here for variable rate application of fertilizer is to improve our crop yields, reduce the chance of water contamination again by runoff, as Paul pointed out, and potentially we can reduce the amount of fertilizer being used with this technology. And we're helping the farmers be better stewards of the soil. Some of the latest technology that we've developed as well is a telemetry program, which even allows us to map a field out. So from in the office, they can maybe put a geofence around a watershed area, and they'll be notified either by text or by phone or by computer when the machine crosses into that area. So we know precisely when that's taken effect.
That's right. Excuse me. And Mr. Jorgensen, you know, you brought up, thank you for the details on the cost, the investment, and stuff like that. You brought that up. There's definitely positive value to the state, agriculture in general, and the water quality issue that we're talking about to make this investment. And we should be talking with some of the others, whether it's the Environment Committee and maybe with the Legacy Fund, to talk about what opportunities that we would have as a state to invest in this type of technology as well. So we need to continue having those conversations. I would request if we could get a copy of your PowerPoint as well, if that's okay. All right. Sorry, did I interrupt? You have
nope.
More to your presentation?
Yes,
questions, members? Any questions? So, Representative Szymanski.
We can't go without a question at some point. Thank you.
Oh, we could, but that's all right.
Sorry, gentlemen, I didn't jot down your names, but in your the first portion of the discussion, we talked about nutrient management and increasing organic matter in the soil and so forth. There's also discussion around here of harvesting crop residues for renewable energy sources. Are you taking that into account in some of your calculations for nutrient management as well at this point, or are you just going to anticipate that at a future point?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schumanski, at this point, we look at the harvesting or the organic matter increase. I mean, at this point, the harvesting of residue as a alternate source of biofuel, we have not, that's probably in its infancy stages. That's at the university level. They're looking at this. That is a big concern of producers when they look at this. They look at that, the value of that organic matter, and frankly, from my perspective, they are somewhat reluctant to sell off that residue, because a lot of growers that have, there are some growers that they'll bale their corn stalks for bedding for their livestock. And there are certain ramifications by doing that, and they've seen that. And so down the road, and this is my personal opinion and kind of what I gather from what my producers are telling me, they probably are going to be somewhat reluctant to do that.
Representative Schumanski? No? Yeah. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a quick question and then a question for the chair. My question is about the $5 application versus $7 application in the earlier slide. I'm just being a little slow in this, and I apologize. I'm trying to what is the $5 or $7 for? I'm trying to figure out why the one's more expensive than the other. So what is that money for, if you could let me know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Jorgens.
The difference would be a non-variable rate piece of application, of course, costs less. They can cover more acres per day with it, so they don't charge as much. And that charge is just for the machine to spread the fertilizer per acre.
Per acre charge.
Yeah, that's a per acre charge.
And if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, I think I'd like to follow up on your observation earlier. There are several bills before the House about the sales tax on ag equipment and the depreciation at the federal level and matching the federal to the Minnesota. Certainly, I imagine that this committee could propose a policy direction in which we suggest maybe the exemption apply to certain types of equipment that have the benefits that are being described here. So it's a suggestion just following up from your comment earlier.
Well, thank you, Representative Morrow. I know I was working with Representative Faust, former Representative Faust, on this very issue. So we'll continue these conversations. Thank you. Representative Anderson, Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a question, have $6 corn and $13 soybeans led to a spike in interest for this type of technology, or is this something that's just been growing gradually, and as fertilizer prices rise, what's been your growth, I guess my question is, in this industry?
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
and
Trishka.
Representative Anderson, your question being, the growth, the higher price of the commodities. With the higher prices of commodities also leads to higher input costs, whether it's, and we're seeing this all the way from landlords saying, well, okay, you're getting $6 a bushel for corn. And let's see, they can do the math themselves. They say, okay, you're getting 200 bushels. They now are asking for higher land costs. So the fertilizer, the inputs have also gone up tremendously, primarily your fertilizers. They've gone up. And so what this has done is producers look at, and this is part of this increase in growth in the precision ag has been growers saying, hey, we're not going to be out there applying fertilizer where we don't need it. When fertilizer was cheap, they did a lot of things that weren't agronomically correct. And from an economic point of view, it didn't hurt them. But now, when the prices are where they're at, they have to pay a lot more attention to that, and they've looked at this, and primarily the year 2008, when potash prices spiked at $800 a ton, phosphate was at $1,000 a ton, we had growers coming in our door, we want you to go out, soil sample our field, because we soil sample our field, because we see what it's doing, we understand this. Does that answer your question, Mr. Anderson?
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again. No, I really appreciate your comments, and it shows that the farmers, if they're forced to or not, but by economic conditions, are becoming better stewards of the land.
Correct.
And doing a better job. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morrow.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know, Mr. Chair, we want to move on, but I'm really fascinated by this. And the question I have is about the technology and the education it would take to run the technology, because I know even my VCR light still does the 12 o'clock. So as this equipment becomes more available, is there training, education that folks need to be able to run this? We've talked a lot about ag education and technology and the like in this committee. So I'm just wondering what it takes to actually run the equipment.
From tomorrow, I look to my children when it comes to the running the VCR and everything else. Mr. Trishka, would you like to?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Marr. To answer your question about the increase in education, yes, it does take additional training. Applicator drivers have to be, because in there, in the cab of their machine, whether it's a farmer running a combine with the yield monitor, whether they're doing a farmer running a variable rate seeding operation, or somebody running a variable rate spreader in the field, it's all based on a Windows-based frame network. So they have to understand file structure and these kind of things. And there a lot of support comes from the growers. Spend a lot of time, and that's where the service comes in with their suppliers such as AGCO or John Deere or Case IH, because they're calling them and saying, hey, I got this icon on here, I can't get it to go. So they spend, and with the cell phone technology, they spend a lot of time calling. But yes, your question is education. There are training opportunities, but they still rely on people to make that, and you know, like whether it's a dealership, whether it's somebody like that, to help them, because they're in the field and they have to start planting. They want to go now, and they're not going to pull out a book, and so they're going to go.
All right, very well. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just to say, we have a large meeting in December. We would like to invite the committee members and your staff to come and see some of this equipment. And we do training there as well in cooperation with the Department of Ag. And so we'll make sure that you have a chance to attend that if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. So, again, we're educated, we're professional, we're farmers. Thank you so much for your testimony. We'd ask the department to make their way up here, please. We need to have someone move the minutes. Representative Torkelson moves the minutes dated February 16th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. All right. Next up, we do have members from the department. If you'd please state your name and who you represent for the committee. And I would just like to say thank you for allowing us to move the testifiers in before you. We appreciate that. Great deal. So please.
Mr. Chairman, you're very welcome. I'm Greta Gothier. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Agriculture. Thank you for asking us over here today to talk about clean water funded projects that our agency is involved with. I'm going to turn it over to a couple people who are very much on the ground with these projects in the field. First, we'll hear from Dr. Adam Burr and then Mr. Bruce Montgomery.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, I'm Adam Burr. I'm the Impaired Waters Technical Coordinator for the Department of Agriculture. Today I'm going to provide an overview of some of the activities that we've engaged in relative to research, demonstration projects, and technical assistance with our most recent Clean Water Fund allocation.
Do we need some help up there so we can get that going?
Mr. Chairman, I think we do.
That's right. There we go.
There's three areas I'd like to highlight today. One is some of the research we've engaged in, as well as a couple of demonstration projects that we've engaged in this last year. Relative to the research, in FY11, we recently had an RFP, a request for proposals out this past fall. We had $1.25 million available, and this was available to any organization, research entity, or individual. The proposal process was guided by three main research priorities. These priorities were developed in coordination with a interagency research coordination team, as well as input from an ad hoc advisory group of producer groups. We evaluated these proposals this winter with a committee that was made up of that interagency research team, as well as two non-agency members. We received 9 proposals, totaling $2.4 million in requests, and we're currently undergoing the contract negotiation process with those projects and hope to have those released and executed in mid to late March. In terms of our research, the overarching goals are to really understand the underlying processes that affect water quality. And we've heard a lot about best management practices today. One area, a huge need in terms of research, is the effectiveness, quantifying the effectiveness of those agricultural practices. And so we've invested a lot in that area. And lastly, we learned quite a bit about precision agriculture in the previous discussion. Another area that we're exploring is taking those same principles of using the technology, GPS and the like, and applying it to the area of conservation, and it's a term that we call precision conservation. Relative to the RFP that we had out this past fall, there are three areas or anticipated outcomes that we foresee. One is a comprehensive inventory of agricultural best management practices. Currently, information on practices is scattered throughout a number of different entities and agencies, and we'd like to create a one-stop shop or handbook of our current understanding of BMPs, both in terms of their effectiveness, current research, costs, etc. Secondly, we'd like to get a better understanding of the relationship between artificial drainage, both surface and subsurface, and water quality and quantity. And lastly, kind of building on this idea of precision conservation, we want to identify a process for identifying priority management zones in the state's 81 major watersheds. And this is done in close collaboration with PCA in their approach to address the impaired waters process. The second initiative that I'd like to talk about, that's changing gears a little bit, is the Discovery Farms Minnesota program. Discovery Farms Minnesota is a farmer-led initiative aimed at gathering information about water quality under different types of farms throughout Minnesota. This builds on a program that has been in existence in Wisconsin for over a decade. With this program, we have multiple partners involved, and you can see here from the pictures sort of what the sites look like. Each site is equipped with a monitoring station. You see there, it's a fiberglass structure that allows us to quantify all the flow that goes through from that drainage area, from that field. And we use electronic monitoring equipment to collect the samples and gauge what that flow is. And we do this 365 days a year, so we're collecting snowmelt as well as rain events. Partnership is really a key tenet to this program. We're partnering with the Minnesota Ag Water Resources Coalition, which is made up of more than a dozen producer groups in the state. We, the department, our role in this program is really offer the technical expertise and the monitoring, so we're coordinating the monitoring. We're also offering assistance with equipment. We're working directly with the SWCDs, the watershed districts, the local organizations that are responsible for actually collecting and maintaining the samples and the equipment and so forth. So we're coordinating with these locals as they collect the data. There is a very formal structure to how Discovery Farms is constructed, and it builds on the Wisconsin program. There's a steering committee that guides the overall direction of the program. And as I mentioned before, there's environmental and farm management data that's collected year-round, both in terms of water quantity, quality, weather data, and farm management practices. Currently, we have 4 operational sites in Minnesota. This program is about a year in now. We anticipate a year from now we'll probably have 10 or more sites. And the future sites currently were in Kandiyohi, Goodhue, Stearns, and Chisago counties. In the future, we'll focus our efforts on the Minnesota and Cedar River basins. A program that's very complementary to the Discovery Farms program is the Root River Field to Stream Partnership. Again, emphasizing partnerships, you see the organizations listed at the bottom, the Minnesota Ag Water Resources Coalition, the Nature Conservancy, Monsanto and in ourselves. There are also a number of key partners in terms of soil water conservation districts, and some of the research entities are playing a key role in this partnership and program as well. Really, the goal of this program is to help Southeast Minnesota farmers and policymakers better understand the relationship between agricultural practices and water quality. We've heard a lot about best manager practices, best manager practice effectiveness. One area that we're really struggling in terms of research is best manager practice effectiveness at the watershed scale. We have a lot of data collected at the university and agricultural stations at the field scale, but how do we link the effectiveness we measure at the field scale on up to the watershed scale when we're implementing BMPs? And that's really what this program is trying to address. So we have monitoring at multiple scales. We're also exploring the newest in tools and technology, and that includes utilizing some of the new LIDAR high-resolution topographic data that's been collected in the region. How can we use that to use this precision conservation? Monitoring really is the main part of this project. We're, like I said, we're monitoring at multiple scales. We're monitoring at the subwatershed outlet scale. That gives us a long-term record to tell us about what's going on when we start to implement various practices in the watershed. It also tells us something about the cumulative effects of all the different land uses and cropping systems in that watershed. But we're also scaling up and looking at the edge of field too, and looking at a variety of different farm enterprises that are indicative to that region. We're at three watersheds within the Root River watershed. The Root itself is about 1 million acres. We're in three sub-watersheds, each that are about 5,000 acres, that represent the three major geomorphic regions of the Root. Everywhere from subsurface tile drainage with poorly drained soils in the western part of the basin to the rolling bluff and karstland of the east. Within a 20-mile drive, you can encounter very different regions, and so we're trying to capture representative watersheds within each of those regions. In addition to the monitoring, we have a number of activities that help complement the monitoring. We're working with university, both at Winona State University and the University of Minnesota, to look at stream channel characteristics. We're not only looking at what's going on at the edge of field, but what's going on in the channel network itself. We're also using the latest in agronomic assessments, including basal stock testing that tells us something about nitrogen availability. We're also doing soil testing and manure testing as well. And again, another new technology that we're looking at is sediment fingerprinting that allows us to track soil loss that we collect, the samples that we collect throughout the watershed. It also tells us something about the geologic history of the watershed relative to sediment movement. And so there are a lot of very new sort of cutting-edge technologies and research that we're employing in this particular study. In terms of progress to date, we first installed both sites a little over a year ago. And 2010 was our first monitoring season. Like I said, we started with snowmelt last year. We had a above average growing season rainfall with more than 30 inches of precip throughout the watershed. We collected more than 400 samples throughout the study, including the outlet sites as well as the edge of field sites. We also collected a number of the basal stock samples, soil samples, and the like. We're currently conducting farm practice surveys in the watershed too. We have established relationship with our local staff out of Preston, working one-on-one with each of the producers in these three small watersheds. There's about 30 producers in all that we're working with, and we work very closely with them. The pictures you see at the bottom sort of highlight one of these edge of field monitoring systems, and in this case, a snowmelt. This is actually from last year, although we experienced a very similar phenomena last week. And one thing you should notice from these pictures is that these events are very episodic and occur very quickly, both snowmelt and rainfall events. So you see the far left picture shows what the site looked like on March 4th. Snowmelt began on March 11th, and then by March 15th, almost all the snow is gone. And so this particular site, water was actually flowing through the flume for a total of about 6 hours. So these are very short-term duration events. We see the same phenomena with rainfall events too. So you're setting up a system that you might be capturing 4 to 6 events per year.
Dr. Burr, about 12 minutes with questions, okay?
And with that, actually, I think I will transfer over to Mr. Montgomery to talk about some of our other activities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bruce Montgomery, and I'm a soil scientist and unit supervisor of what's called Fertilizer Management Unit. This next presentation, or segment of it, is a little bit shifting gears, but I think it fits in very well with the presentation of, regarding precision agriculture. And what I'd like to give you a very, very quick update on is AFREC, or Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council. The mission of that council basically is to fund research and education on soil fertility that is environmentally and economically sound. So again, I think that lends itself very well into what we were hearing previously. A little bit different, we're not talking about clean water funding here. This particular program is fueled by 40-cent ton on our fertilizer tonnage fee. 100% of this program is funded by Minnesota farmers. There's a handout in your packet that gives you a little bit of an update on this very young program. One of the reasons I wanted to give you that was so you knew a little bit about some of the newly funded projects just in the last year or so. The program's been around for 3 years. It's been moving very, very quickly. I get very excited about it because it is farmers leading this charge. This is a 12-member council representing 11 different farm groups. And just for the record, they make all of the decisions on where that money goes. And the Department of Ag's role, by the way, is to help with a lot of the technical assistance, organization. We do a lot of the fiscal management of the funds. But it's really this council that represents the heart of Minnesota farming to provide whatever research is needed. Very quickly, a couple of the achievements over the last few years. Again, this council has moved very quickly to get this program moving along. In partnership since the fall of 2000, three different RFPs have gone out, and we've issued $1.2 million so far. Currently, there's 24 projects that are either completed or ongoing or will be started this coming spring. I'd like to switch back quickly to the legacy account and just give you a couple examples with Dr. Burr. And by the way, he never showed the slide of him being out last week at midnight with his miner's hat on shoveling these flumes out. There's an awful lot of field work that goes into this stuff, and we certainly appreciate that. I'd like to just highlight a couple of things on what's going on with groundwater. There is a part of the legacy funds that are dedicated for groundwater protection. Just like to showcase just a couple of projects, but all of them, again, as the theme this morning is local partnerships. We really rely heavily on our local soil and water districts or our environmental health offices. And the idea here is how do we collectively come up with very practical solutions with common goals with our local partners. And with a little bit of legacy money we have dedicated for this helps us get pilots developed with the idea here that if they're successful, we'd like to bring them to other parts of the state. Two quick examples. Assistance to our Minnesota irrigators is a key one that features various segments, including irrigation scheduling. A lot of climatology data is needed for proper irrigation scheduling and making sure that they have the right tools, the evapotranspiration information they need to make those daily decisions on when and if to water. And again, the educational part is really key. One of the things that we're challenged with is we've seen a very large increase in irrigation permits through the DNR. We know that there's an awful lot of new irrigators out there just in the last 4 to 5 years. Currently, there's no formal training for them. And we see this as very, very key. Many of the areas where we are experiencing elevated nitrates and groundwater supplies, particularly in our wellhead protection areas, tend to be in these coarse textured soils, and frequently it's where these high value irrigated crops are grown. So careful management of both water and nitrogen is absolutely key, and what we'd like to do is help provide outreach to get that done, as well as setting up ET hotlines. This is information where a grower can call in every day, find out what the potential water uses of that crop, and help them with that scheduling. The last example I'm going to provide is, again, partnering with 14 counties. This happens to be in the Central Sands of Minnesota, where we do have a lot of very vulnerable soils due to coarse textured, low organic matter, shell depth of groundwater. And what we're trying to do with these counties is really try to characterize what is our current nitrate status in private drinking water supplies. We do know from past activities that we have elevated hotspots throughout the Central Sands. This project will do a one-time sampling of 2,500 wells. We're currently right in the heart of that. We're relying heavily on homeowners to participate with us, but the idea here is to really get a good idea of what the current conditions are and then use a subset of those 2,500 homeowners to develop a long-term trend assessment. So with that, I guess we'll open it up for questions that you may have, and thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions, members? Any questions? Mr. Montgomery, you've heard some of the testimony here earlier with Precision Agriculture. Your professional observation with the best management practices that are being implemented in and around agriculture, do you think we're heading in the right direction from your personal professional experience?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great question. I've been in the department 20 years. First of all, to me, this is the most exciting time I've ever been here with all of these various projects moving forward. We know and we've carefully identified where we have some problematic areas. There's a few key things that continually are problems, and Julie talked about some of them. A lot of times they're related to manure management. That's probably one of our more complicated and critical pieces in a sound nutrient management plan. The soil and water districts, with the help of financial aid from Bowser and technical assistance from the Department of Ag, extension and so forth, I think we're in really, really good shape. It's exciting to have this checkoff program. That, by the way, this coming fall, there will be $800,000 a year maximum for this type of research. Again, the council makes the decisions on the priorities, and we heard a lot of good, interesting things about precision agriculture and how you get that information out. I would guess that once we start to iron out some common soil fertility recommendations down the road, that the council will probably start looking at that type of technology as well. Personally, I feel very good at where we're at. Education, making sure that the growers and dealers get the proper education they need is absolutely critical. That's why we feel these very localized demonstrations that we're either doing with groundwater or surface water, as Dr. Burr talked about, are really critical.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. And with the comment about manure management as well, I know in my private sector life, working in pork production, we're doing a lot with the precision type of agriculture with applying manure to the farm fields as well and agronomic rates and et cetera. So thank you very much for your comments. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Montgomery, are we on the cutting edge with our research? Are other states in the upper Midwest doing similar things, or you'd reference the irrigation in the sand plains? Like California, are they doing the same type of monitoring and research?
Mr. Montgomery?
Chair, Representative Szymanski. Great question. Quite frankly, when the task force that was the predecessor to the Research Council got together, one of the purposes of that task force was really to identify needs, where the state of Minnesota is at in terms of other states, and do we need a checkoff program like this? We had a great opportunity to look at what Wisconsin was doing, Illinois, Iowa, California, all of these programs had existing checkoff programs, which means dedicated dollars to do this type of work. What's really critical with this funding now is long term. And a lot of soil fertility research, as you know, in the apple business, it takes a long time to get it developed. Quite frankly, the University of Minnesota has been running on fumes for about the past two decades, and it's going to take some time for us to catch up. We heard a lot about precision ag this morning. The university was the center of precision ag for many years before the passing of Dr. Pierre Robert, who developed a lot of this technology. I think there's going to be a time when we're caught back up, but we're really in the right direction. I'm really excited about where this is going.
Thank you. And Dr. Burr, when you're, I guess the comment was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's also good to know that we have individuals that are out in the field, if you will, not only, you know, sitting in here. Sometimes there's a perception that all we do is sit behind a desk or whatever, so I just wanted to raise that as well. Thank you for that. Any other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence at this late hour. Just a quick question on the water quality thing for drinking water wells. I think a lot of people, you know, we hear a lot about nitrates in drinking water wells, and if people get that checked and it's okay at a safe level, Are they correct in assuming that drinking water is safe, or are there other things that need to be checked with drinking water as well?
Mr. Montgomery.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson. Great question. The Department of Ag has provided considerable water testing over the last two decades to homeowners to answer that very question. This was a clinic program that was developed through LCMR and other soft-funded programs. During the course of about 15 years, the department and, again, its local partners had the opportunity to conduct free water testing for rural residents with their private drinking water. Those results range all over the board, but it was really an important vehicle for education and making sure that homeowners knew what to do if their nitrates were elevated. But secondly, what else to be looking for? And bacteria is another very common problem. We probably see between 6 and 10% of Minnesota's private drinking water exceed the nitrate standard of 10 parts per million. Anytime we see elevated numbers, obviously wall construction is a big issue, and we would want them to really encourage them to use a certified lab for bacteria testing. That is another very common problem. Pesticides, generally those are not found. We do have a very nice website where the homeowners can have samples shipped to various testing labs throughout the country, and in some cases do it fairly affordable. We're always concerned about that, but through our monitoring programs, we have a pretty good idea of what, at least from agricultural inputs, what's going to be a problem and what isn't. One of the problems we're experiencing is always some of these superficial aquifers become contaminated, and some of them have, that the public water supplies are forced to drill deeper into these formations, and then we find other contaminants like radon and so forth that we have to deal with. So bacteria and nitrate, to answer your question, are the biggest problems we have. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
So Dr. Brewer, Mr. Montgomery, thank you so much for your testimony and for all that you do. We're all in this together, and I appreciate it. Ms. Gothier, thank you. I know that we are on for the next couple of days with the department.
Yep.
Members, we're going to be taking testimony from the departments as far as zeroing in on this budget. The governor's released his governor's proposal, and now it's time to get down to business. So make sure everybody's here to hear that testimony, ask your questions, because like I said, we're going to be tackling that here very, very soon. So thank you so much.
Thank
I look
you,
forward
Mr.
to it. Meeting adjourned.